Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Coming up today, we'll be talking with the cheese guy. He lives, breathes, sleeps, thinks, eats, and writes cheese. And today, we'll be talking about cheddar, what it can tell us about our history, cultural identity, and food politics. Surprisingly, really interesting book. We'll also follow up with someone I dubbed my queen of sound bites. She's Sue Akins. She lives 197 miles north of the Arctic Circle. And she's featured in National Geographic Television's Life Below Zero, The Thaw. One of her biggest challenges this year is going from tough to fluff. But first, word nerds rejoice. It's that time of year again when new words are officially sanctioned and added to the dictionary. And this year, more than 500 new words have been added to the American Heritage Dictionary. And Steve Kleinadler is the executive editor. He joins me to share a few of those. All of the people, the editors of the American Heritage Dictionary, are professional lexicographers. And Steve Kleinadler, as I said, is the executive editor of the reference group at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. They publish American Heritage Dictionary. They publish Webster's New World Reference Works. And Steve joined the editorial staff of the American Heritage Dictionary in 1997 and worked as a freelance editor for several reference titles. He's been doing this a long, long time. Boy, does he really is passionate about his work. In fact, all of my three guests today are really passionate about what they do. So I sat down last week and I talked with Steve, and we're going to bring that conversation to you now. And we begin with him responding to, he's telling us how they decide which words to add to the dictionary. Steve Kleinadler.
It depends on the kind of word that it is. With the medical terminology, our life science editor worked with a couple of medical consultants over the past several years. In addition to all of that, the psychiatry terminology is in the process of being overhauled because the DSM, the statistical manual that psychiatrists use to diagnose different disorders, was just updated for the first time in about 10 years, a couple years ago. So we're sorting through all of that. In these specialty areas, the consultants or even the editors, if they have special expertise, will say, hey, we've got these gaps, you know, we need to include this, or there's this new disorder, it should go in, or as you'll see, some of the information we sent you, what people used to call a coronary angioplasty is now referred to in the medical field as a percutaneous coronary intervention.
Right.
So these specialists will say, hey, this is the terminology now, you should use it. On the other side of the fence, we have words like food. Food terminology is always interesting to discuss. A, people like to eat, but also it shows you how words gradually enter English. 100 years ago, for example, we brought in a lot of words from Italian, and 50, 60 years ago with the rise of French cuisine and Julia Child's efforts and that sort of thing, you saw a rise in French terminology that was brought into English. And so, too, in the past decade or two, as American cuisines have expanded globally, you will see a variety of different words come into play. How we decide to enter them, a good example here is bibimbap, which is a type of Korean rice dish. Personally, I had that back in the 80s when I lived in a neighborhood in Chicago that was adjacent to a Korean neighborhood, so I was familiar from it. But for a long time, it was pretty much relegated to Korean restaurants in Korean neighborhoods. But in the past several years, you see bibimbap appearing on other menus outside of Korean restaurants. You'll see articles in national newspapers and blogs and the like where they refer to this without defining what it is, indicating that you should already know what it is, and that's a good indication that the word is ready to be entered into the dictionary. You know, the first wave is when, you know, they're talking about these new recipes and whatnot, and they'll bring up this term that comes from a foreign language, and they'll have to explain what it is. After a few years, that explanation goes away because it's assumed to be part of the cultural knowledge.
Right. So under general interest terms, I love this word. It kind of sounds a bit like an oxymoron. Humble brag. Tell us about that.
Yes. Humble brag is a superficially modest or self-deprecating statement that is meant to impress other people. It is, you know, definitely one of the cutesier words that we added this year, but there are, you know, certainly a large number of those that one runs into, whether you're reading news articles online or blogs or what have you, and it's found its way into pop culture, sitcoms, that kind of thing. So it's a nice, cute term for this situation that most people, you know, can relate to. It's like, oh yeah, so and so when they were complaining about not having, you know, enough money to do X, but X was something very fantastic and amazing. They were actually kind of bragging about the fact that they could, in fact, do this kind of thing.
Okay, and so that's a humble brag. As a writer, I asked a friend, have you ever heard the term listicle? And he had not either, but that's on there too now.
Yes, listicles are everywhere, especially in the last decade or so. The American propensity for making lists of things, if you recall back in the 70s and 80s, Irving Wallace and his son David Walachensky put out these books called The Book of Lists, which were just basically, you know, the 10 most this or the 100 most that. And nowadays, you'll see these listicles. A listicle is an article or an essay written in the form of a numbered list. So you'll go to a place like BuzzFeed and you'll see, you know, the 7 shocking things that this sitcom actor said, or you won't believe these 5 crazy things that happened, you know, in front of the New York Public Library or what have you, as a way of drawing people in. We have seen what was once kind of the realm of almost clickbait or inviting people in to take a look at these websites. Even print magazines, you know, do this now. If you've been in an airplane lately and reading the in-flight magazine, which is big and bold and has lots of pictures and, you know, big graphics, you'll see a lot of things that are in list form. And that's made its way into other magazines too. It's almost like an infographic. It's very easily digestible factoids in list form.
And I see that, you know, since we're up here in Seattle and, you know, constantly drinking coffee and typically have sleeves around our cup, the new word for that is zarf.
Yes, zarf is actually itself a fairly old word and referring to a holder for a hot cup, usually made of ornamental metal. And because it exists as the term was extended, perhaps originally ironically or kind of making fun of it because of the ubiquity of the cardboard sleeves, but over time the meaning was extended to refer to the cardboard sleeve itself that would, you know, when you get a hot cup of coffee so that you don't burn your hands, the little cheap cardboard sleeve that they put there. This is an example of an existing word that has a new sense added to it. And it ultimately, zarf, ultimately comes from an Arabic word meaning container.
Yeah, interesting. Why do we change the way that we pronounce words? And I'm looking here at what Americans would typically say agoraphobia. Me being British, I would say agoraphobia, and that is now changing.
Well, there's certainly sociolinguists have a field day of, you know, why not only individual words but how vowel sound changes. How, you know, someone in the middle of the country might say pot, but someone in the near the Great Lakes region might say pat, or, you know, what have you. The different they're called vowel shifts. But in this case, with between agoraphobia and agoraphobia, there's a complete stress shift. It starts somewhere and it just picks up popularity. In this case, I grew up saying agoraphobia myself, and perhaps agoraphobia is considered to sound more British or something. You'll note that this is something that we balloted to our usage panel, and in 2001, 66% preferred the traditional pronunciation of agoraphobia, and in just 13 years, the proportion that preferred the traditional pronunciation dropped from 66% to 43%, and not only that, the newer pronunciation was acceptable to more panelists than the traditional pronunciation was, So things change over time. Another good example of that is whether it's harass or harass. About 20 years ago, it was pretty evenly split, and in the past 20 years, it's moved to where about 90% of the panel prefers harass to harass. So these things kind of, language is constantly evolving, constantly shifting and changing, and sometimes these things just take on a life of their own, and people start using it, and whether it's because people who say it, the people who want to be thought of to be like them, or there's a variety of sociolinguistic reasons that that this comes about. One picks up steam and takes off.
Yeah, it is very interesting. I keep saying that because it is to me, because I'm kind of a word nerd. But it's sometimes I've thought, oh, they've spelt that wrong, and then I go look it up, and it's actually now in the new dictionary. So it's constantly evolving. This one bugs me: orientate.
Yes. it's funny because part of the, it bugs a lot of people, and it bugs a lot of Americans. And orientate is actually more common in British English, and British English speakers tend to be less annoyed by it than Americans do. But you're right, here you've got the word, much like the difference between utilize and use. In pretty much any circumstance where you use orientate, you could just say orient. And in 2014, 80% of our usage panel took disapproved of the use orientate in most situations, and preferring it to orient. So they are definitely on your side with that one.
Mm. Do you have a favorite of the 500 plus words we've added this year? Do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite per se? No. I mean, it's like asking carpenters what their favorite nails are. They just, you know, I sift through so many words every year. Some of the things that I really enjoy talking about that I think, you know, because obviously I'm a word nerd too, is the way that we have a freelance etymologist who discovers, who delves into the history of words and really goes far back to determine how a word came to enter English. Those of your listeners interested in the word marjoram, which is, you know, the spiced herb that you can put in food. Mm-hmm. If you go to our website at ahdictionary.com and type it in, you can see this extremely expansive etymology. It was originally just very short, and then he tied it into early modern English and Middle French and Middle English and Old French and Medieval Latin and Late Latin, and related it to a Persian word, an Arabic word, and a Greek and Macedonian terminology. So you get this little paragraph of how this word ties in with so many other words in other languages, and how it might have come to mean what it means.
Yeah, and I see also on your blog you sometimes do those kind of posts on your blog too, which people might like to look at. Now, I understand you don't like deleting words, but do you ever delete words?
Very rarely. Our philosophy is we try not to put in a word unless we think it's going to stick around. In the past 3 years, I think we've deleted maybe a dozen. In most cases, it was really obsolescent. In some cases, it was obsolescent medical terminology, where a really old term had really fallen out of favor in favor of another one. And it wasn't like a term where people were familiar with. It was an obscure term to begin with that's been changed to something else. Or the fact that, you know, we used to have an entry for element 114, and then when it was discovered and named fluorovium, you know, we didn't need to include element 114 anymore as an entry in and of itself. So yeah, you're right. We try not to delete stuff, and when we do, there's usually some argument to be made that it's very obsolescent or shouldn't have been there to begin with.
Yeah, and so your new dictionary is out and available right now. What do you want to leave listeners with today?
I think if your listeners are like you, they love language, and we love people who love language, regardless of whether they're using books in print, which we certainly have, or our information, which is completely up to date online at the website I mentioned, ahdictionary.com. And I want to thank all your listeners for listening to this and continuing to be passionate about words.
And that was the executive editor of the American Heritage Dictionary, Steve Klein-Edler. And if you want to find out more, of course, go to ahdictionary.com or go to your iTunes or Android app store, and you can purchase the application and download everything. Or, of course, you know, get the print version from the bookstore. Coming up next, we will be revisiting Sue Akins, who lives 197 miles north of the Arctic Circle. While some women collect shoes, she collects bullets. So stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
You must have thrown 1,000 pitches teaching him to hit a home run. Spent countless Saturdays running routes so he could learn to hit an open receiver. Endless afternoons teaching him how to hit the three-pointer. But how much time have you spent teaching him what not to hit? Teaching boys that all violence against women is wrong is one of the most important things a man can do. Learn how to start the conversation at teachearly.org. Brought to you by Futures Without Violence and the Ad Council.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, gift ideas for the creative in your life, plus Brian Bailey, a.k.a. The Wolf Whisperer, and the latest best-selling fact-tastic bathroom reader full of odd news, weird facts, quirky quotes, and head-scratching oddities. An ideal gift from Uncle John or Uncle John. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Bringing you fresh perspectives every day. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. Well, they say that when you live in Alaska, you work until the sun goes down. And if you've ever seen National Geographic's hit television series, Life Below Zero, you'll know that's true. This season is called The Thaw. You'll see various characters in this, but one of my favorites, actually my favorite, is Sue Akins. The show airs Tuesday nights, and today we're going to be joined by Sue Akins. I actually sat down with her last week. You know, it's a little difficult to do interviews 197 miles north of the Arctic Circle, but we sat down and we chatted. She's 80 miles from the nearest road. She is as tough as the grizzly bear that attacked her and left her for dead several years ago. And she was on Conversations Live a couple of years ago. And so I wanted to see what's happened since then and what's coming up in the new season. And so here's Sue Akins from National Geographic Channel's Life Below Zero, The Thaw. Well, I have a funny story to start with, Sue, because this summer I was in Barbados and I couldn't sleep. And so I flicked the TV on. I'm walking around my apartment in my hotel. And suddenly I hear this voice and I think, I know that voice. So I go back into the other room, look at the television, and it's you on the TV in your show. So very excited to have you back and find out what's been happening since we last talked. But you've had quite a serious injury, I understand. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, you know, it happened on February 18th. I had a snow machine accident, and I kind of got caught on the river, a little bit of overflow coming out, and went into an unrecoverable side slide, and you know, when I hit, you see me get tossed from the snow machine, but when I hit, you don't see a lot of snow poofing up. So that means I hit solid ice. And quite a few breaks. In the last 8 months, I've had 7 major surgeries, but I'm getting back on track now.
Yeah. So you've not been back. You're at CAVIC, which is it's a filling station, bed and breakfast for bush pilots. Do you also take hunters up there?
Yeah, well, you know, any reason that you want to be in the high Arctic and you need a place to stay or some food or some fuel, then that's there for. During the month of August, I do get hunters that come through, but probably the largest chunk of the people are ologists, whether you're a hydrologist, geologist. The sciences do a lot of studying up there, and then ecotourism, a lot of bird watchers.
Yeah, and so you had a ton of stuff to get done, and as I understand it, you'd been away from camp for 4 months recovering from your injury, but you're still not fully recovered. So you get back there, and there's all this work to do.
Yeah, there's, you know, I mean, once you, and especially the key months, you know, February is still deep winter, but, you know, by the time I made it down and started having surgeries to fix the, you know, I'm in my mid-50s. I don't bounce anymore. I break. And so there's a lot of parts that needed to be fixed. But what happened in the interim was that winter got over, spring came in, and then we started summer. So, yeah, there's just a ton of chores that piled up. And for me, I had to come up against that wall of actually realizing, unless I wanted to keep re-breaking myself, I need to admit I can't do it on my own, and I had to get a little bit of help this year.
Yeah, and that didn't look easy for you to come to that realization, but it's also a strength to recognize that, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, and that's one of the keys about being out so far is you must be brutally honest with yourself, even if you don't want to hear it. Some of the truths are ugly, but that doesn't mean you don't have to look at them and deal with them. And while I'm not ready to admit that I need to have help permanently, I absolutely did have to have help for the summer.
Yeah. Well, just to let listeners know, to refresh, I mean, you live 500 miles from the nearest city, 80 miles from the closest road. You've been up there for 7 years, but I understand you've been in Alaska for a total of 30.
I've been up at CAVIC. This will be my 13th year.
Oh, 13th, okay.
Yeah, it's been about 7 years, 7 or 8 years, I think, since the bear attack. But, you know, I've been up in Alaska since the late 60s.
And so you finally, last time we talked, I said you were my queen of sound bites because you come out with these great one-liners during the show all the time. And it's so droll the way you come out with them. It makes me laugh. It cracks me up. I love it. And so you said you decided you're going to have to call in some help and you wanted to call your nephew. You said it's time to go from tough to fluff and make that call. And up he came. He came very quickly for you, too.
Yeah. Yeah, he was down in the Fairbanks area. He's one of my brother's kids. And, you know, really, you know, he came up to scratch. As you see, as the summer progresses, there are some things that come up, and he really had to come up to the test. He had to fill my boots a little bit, maybe a little bit more than he had planned. But, it emotionally for me to admit that I can't do it on my own is huge, but what a blessing to be able to call him in and have him be able to help.
Yeah, but I mean, he said more than once, you're not doing a one-man job, and you've been doing that for many, many years, so I think he was quite impressed with you. So tell me about the tundra remedy you made, because you weren't feeling well, you're feeling exhausted. You made this tundra remedy with powdered honey, and I think it was it sun tea and fireweed?
Yeah, it's, you know, I have powdered honey. Anything that whenever I'm flying supplies up, you always, always, always are going to be cognizant of the weight of anything you bring in. So you can get dehydrated honey, and that's what I used. I put a bunch of it in my glass teapot. Willow has an acid in it called salic acid. We chemically change that and call it acetylsalicylic acid, which is aspirin. So the salic acid in the willow, if you just put the water in and let it leach, you're going to get a pain-relieving, fever-reducing effect from that, and then, you know, high vitamin C. My body went through a whole lot of damage in a short period of time, and like I say, in my mid-50s, it's harder for me to recover than it might have been in my 20s. So that concoction helps my body help itself.
Right, right. So let's look at some of the things that happen coming up. What is one of your biggest challenges, apart from having to call in help this year? But what's one of the biggest challenges you faced in this season?
Well, I don't want to give away too much story content.
Right.
So,
give us a hint.
I'm not sure. I haven't seen how the stories, how they're coming out. But for me personally, I will never be able to shoot from my right side again. Therefore, I'm not supposed to shoot from either shoulder for another year. So that's a challenge because I hunt for the meat that I eat. And even protecting myself, there are some predators and some things that are after me that I can't talk to death. So I need to come up with a different way of dealing with that does not involve my right side nor my either shoulder. And so you get to see how I do deal with that. And then the chore list. How do I get back to being self-sufficient without compromising what's been done to me, physically?
Right. Now, is this the third season, Sue? Or is...
That is a confusing question. I think it depends on how you look at, because we do the thaw episodes, which are our summer episodes, as well as our winter episodes. I think it's 3 years we've been doing it. We're going into the fourth. Okay. However many seasons that works out to, I'm not sure.
Okay. And so what made you want to do this season? What made you want to do this show, period? Because, you kind of think of people going up there to escape life, and in some ways, this is so much more than a reality show. It is very informative and I think very inspirational to watch all of the characters on the show and watch them overcome the obstacles just to survive up there. But what made you want to stay involved with the show?
I don't think that, and I can probably speak for most of us on the show, we don't go looking to be on a show, however the show found us. And when that happens, the creator of this show created another show called Flying Wild Alaska, and I had been on that. And I liked the premise of this show because it's not... There are many Alaskan shows that are out there, and they're what I would call scripted. You can look at them and go, that's actually happening. But for us, they follow what I do. They don't tell me what to do.
Right.
And that fits my personality. Obviously, if I were going to script the show, I probably would brush my hair more often and not have accidents on camera. But that's not the way life rolls out.
Right, right. So let's look at some of the chores that you've done. I think we saw these in the first episode. This is going to be the second episode, which will air Tuesday, December 15th. But we saw Jesse come in to help you out. One of the things you had to do was put water in the camp. There's room, I think, for about 80 plus people in the camp itself, but there's no running water. So tell us how you actually get water into the camp.
For me, it's a protected ecosystem. I am not allowed to drill a well, and there would be hardships involved in drilling a well through your permafrost. But so what I have to do is go to the river, and I have to pump it from the river all the way up into the camp facility. But because it's being the way the state views it, as a Caucasian, I can't own the land, and running a business, you have to make sure that the products you're offering the public are 100% healthy. So that water then has to go into a purification process and then stored. So that's how I do the water. You've got to roll this huge, it's a long ways between the water house and the river.
Yeah.
So I've got to pump it up there, filter it, treat it, and then store it, and then pump it all around camp for when people need it.
Yeah.
There's a huge process that has to happen before you can turn on your faucet.
Yes, unlike your nephew, I was surprised you've done that by yourself for so long. And the other thing he helped in that first episode that I saw was removing 500-pound snow tracks from your bobcat, and you used to do that by yourself.
Yeah, and that was really where I hit my wall. Two things happened where, you know, I have to put the new windsock had to go up, and I needed to get those big heavy tracks off of my bobcat. Well, the injuries, and at that point, what the viewer doesn't know is I have around 200 stitches across my chest and shoulder, and I just had to admit that no matter how badly I wanted to push it, it wouldn't be healthy for me to push it. You know, my doctor is eventually going to see the episode and go, "What the heck are you doing, Sue? Really?" And so, I mean, I had to sit there and think about that and go, "Wow, yep, I'm going to need some help."
Right. So apart from injuries that you've sustained, how has your life changed since the series began?
I have less privacy than I used to. You know, and I don't know how I feel about that. I love, you know, the people that come up on the cruise to film. They're very, very small crews, but they are just these amazing people doing amazing things. And that part can get my, you know, I'm an explorer by nature. What I'm doing right now, I can guarantee you that one day I'm going to see something shiny over the hill and I'm going to have to go explore it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I, you know, I'm a challenge-driven personality. I laid out some challenges for myself with Kavik. Reverse psychology works beautifully on me. If you tell me I can't, I'm going to go run out and do it. I don't know why any of my ex-husbands never figured that out.
X being the word there.
Yeah, well, two of them died to get away. I'm not an easy one to live
with. Oh, dear. Okay. Well, so a lot of people are really fascinated by Alaska in itself and have these fantasies about, you know, these romantic fantasies about escaping to Alaska and being self-sufficient. It's a tough life. I mean, just watching what all of you go through on the show, it's extremely tough. Why do you think people are so fascinated with it?
Well, you know, I mean, escapism is a pretty cool deal. And, you know, no matter where you live on the planet, you're going to run into difficulties. But there is, and I think maybe especially in America, I mean, we had westward expansion, and no matter what we've been from the days of going, you know, ape to man, where we've explored and pushed our boundaries. And Alaska's and Siberia would be some of the last few boundaries that haven't been pushed. And it's a way of challenging yourself.
Yeah. So,
and most people don't have the wherewithal to just, you know, "Hey, honey, I'm going to leave and go for 6 months and see if I can chew on some caribou fat. Thanks."
Right.
They can really do that, so they can do it through the programming.
Yes. And I know you've been up there a while now, so what advice do you give to anyone who's maybe thinking of doing something like that?
Really, really, really make sure of, you know, people ask me, you know, "Hey, what's your advice?" And I do your homework. Alaska is a huge, huge place with many ecosystems. What is important to you about the ecosystem you need to live in? Are trees important? Then don't come to my neck of the woods. And there are, you know, there's a lot of things that way that you need to think about. And then do yourself a favor and come in the late winter, early spring, so that you can buffer that first summer where you need to be super super productive about getting ready for winter. There's no danger you're going to be ready for the first winter you experience 100%, but at least you won't be as far behind the gun.
Right.
If you come in the fall and go into your first winter unprepared, you might as well just have made it a round-trip ticket.
Right, right. So one of the guys on the show said that it isn't important what you do, it's important about how you feel about what you do. Is that something you subscribe to?
That would not have been the way that I wrote it, you know, or said it. But I'm not that person. I'm not sure which one of us would have said that. Sounds like a chip thing. But I think it's important all the way around. What you do is extremely important. You know, I mean, are you getting your jobs done or not? We all have a honey-do list. I mean, I have a honey-sue list. You better be ticking that stuff off. So it is important what you do, how you feel about it. Meh, you may like it, you may hate it, but you better get it done.
Right, right.
You know, but the emotional challenge of, you know, it should be important that you at least like your life. You know, I mean, if I hated what I did, hell, it'd be life above zero, and I'd have a cabana boy on the equator somewhere.
I love it. So maybe next year.
I follow up.
So I was going to ask you, what do you want to happen over the next couple of years? But maybe you just answered that one already.
You know, I try not to plan that far ahead. I know I am getting really super close to the goals that I set out for myself. One of the goals that I set out for myself was being, you know, a 50-year-old fat chick doing it alone on the tundra. I had suggested to some of the oil camps, you know, why don't you guys go alternative energy? Come on, save some money. And that, you know, you can't do that. Well, that was just a challenge for me, and I'm just so close. When I first got to Kavik, it was it took over 250 gallons of fuel a day to run. Now it takes between 4 and 10, and once I get the next few wind turbines in and the next bunch of solar, then it'll be maybe 5 a week.
Wow, that's significant.
So, you know, and that's about as much as you can do. For an eight, you know, a camp, I can house 83 at maximum. I can't imagine wanting to.
Right.
I can do it. But that's a pretty tiny footprint compared to where I started.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Once I stop being challenged, then I'm looking for the next challenge.
Yeah, that's awesome. So we're right at the end of our segment here, but what do you want to leave our listeners with, Sue?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what do I want to leave them with? Have an amazing, happy holiday. Be nice to each other. Challenge yourself. You're the only person that you are born and you die with. Look in the mirror and make sure you're somebody you can respect.
I love that. I actually have a mirror as you exit my studio. It's a quote by Maya Angelou, and it says something like, everything you do say something about you, so when you look in the mirror, have self-respect. That was Sue Akins, and if you want to catch her on television, it's very interesting to watch this show, because as she said, it's not at all scripted. Go to natgeotv.com, or you can watch it on the National Geographic channel, of course, but natgeotv.com, and they do have On Demand playing there. You can also find them at facebook.com/natgeotvus, or follow at Nat Geo Channel on Twitter and Instagram. And National Geographic Channel is available in more than 440 million homes in 171 countries and 45 languages. And the next show is tomorrow. Life Below Zero, The Thor Red Flag premieres Tuesday, December 15th at 9, 8 Central. And unexpected electrical issues put Sue Akins in danger of missing out on her delivery of critical supplies. The Hailstone family, some of the other characters there, must prepare to hunker down in their tents because of severe winds. And again, it's tomorrow, December 15th at 9, 8 Central on Nat Geo channel. All right, coming up next, can you say cheese? Well, stay tuned, and we'll be talking with the cheese guy. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
No! To Alaska, I go north for Russia's own. North to Alaska, I go north for Russia's own. Big Sam left Seattle in the year of 92.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Anti-Icky Poo, the product that gets the stink out, we cover the world of animals. This week, December 20th, it's Harmonic and Energy Shifting Sunday with Jude and Paul Ponton from Whispering Dragon in Seattle. They'll be in the studio with their Accutonic Forks, Tibetan Bowls and Bells, Pua, Didge, and Rattles, ready to do remote sessions for you, your animal friends, your home or business. Open phone lines throughout the show, so call in early. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
You must have thrown 1,000 pitches teaching him to hit a home run. Spent countless Saturdays running routes so he could learn to hit an open receiver. Endless afternoons teaching him how to hit the three-pointer. But how much time have you spent teaching him what not to hit? Teaching boys that all violence against women is wrong is one of the most important things a man can do. Learn how to start the conversation at teachearly.org. brought to you by Futures Without Violence and the Ad Council.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, gift ideas for the creative in your life. Plus, Brian Bailey, a.k.a. The Wolf Whisperer, and the latest best-selling fantastic bathroom reader full of odd news, weird facts, quirky quotes, and head-scratching oddities. An ideal gift from Uncle John for Uncle John. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific time here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Don't forget, this is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My next guest is live with me. He's on the telephone waiting to join us. I've heard that he lives, eats, breathes, thinks, and writes cheese. He loves it so much, he's written two books about it, he blogs about it, and he's been the cheese buyer for San Francisco's Rainbow Grocery Cooperative since 1994. Gordon Edgar has been a judge at numerous national cheese competitions, a board member of the California Artisan Cheese Guild, and has had a blog about cheese since 2002, which can be found at Gordon Zola, Gordon, a play on words there, GordonZola.net. Gordon Edgar, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Vicki.
My pleasure. And the book is called Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. And I'm going to confess, when I first saw the PR stuff come through, I thought this is a cookbook or, you know, what to do with cheese book. But it's not. And there's no pictures in it, yet it's the most fascinating book. So tell us, I understand that this was inspired by a visit. You were taking a pilgrimage to the world's largest cheese. Talk to us about that.
Sure. Well, you know, for years, I'd always wanted to go to this monument that I'd read about. You know, a monument was what I thought I was going to, in Neillsville, Wisconsin, which was, supposedly a replica of the world's largest cheese at that time. You know, like a, you know, 50,000-pound cheddar. And, long story short, you know, I took a long way out of my way to get there. I was driving with a friend across country. We got there, you know, I'm just like super excited. I thought everybody was going to be, you know, there's going to be like a town band or something like that playing. And, you know, I was super excited to get there. And I get there and there's a glass trailer, you know, it's still decorated from the original World Fair of New York, you know, in the 60s. You get there and inside the trailer, I'm like, oh, it's going to be a magnificent replica of cheddar. And instead, it was just a wooden crate. And and I was like, you know, this is a replica of the box that once contained the large cheddar, which I thought was a little disappointing.
Yeah. So you've had a really long love affair with cheese and worked in the industry for a long time, so I know a lot about it. But I understand when you blogged about it or wrote about it and you were just staggered at the number of comments and questions that came in, and it just led to a whole new writing career, if you will, for you.
Absolutely. That the first book I wrote was really in response to how many questions I would just get from random strangers on the internet about cheese, you know. And that book was called Cheesemonger, but it was, you know, basically an attempt to have a longer conversation with people than is possible over a cheese counter or really in internet comments, unless I wanted to spend my whole life doing that. So I've been trying to, you know, kind of demystify cheese for a number of years.
Yeah. And so we're going to get to why cheddar in just a moment, but let's just give our listeners some facts here. The average American, I couldn't believe this, eats 33.5 pounds of cheddar a year. Wisconsin produces 572 million pounds of cheddar annually. So why cheddar? With all of the different types of cheese out there, you know, we kind of think of cheddar as a home staple, if you will.
Yeah, well, you know, it really has to do with the way cheddar's produced in this country. You know, first off, I should say it's 33.5 pounds of cheese in general a year. A lot of that is cheddar, but it's, you know, Americans don't eat 33 pounds each of cheddar alone.
Okay.
Just want to put that out there for any cheese people listening who will call me up and correct me. You know, basically, in the 1850s, the United States took cheddar and made it from a farm cheese into a factory cheese. And then, you know, cheese production has really been concentrated on cheddar Until just a few years ago, 150 years, cheddar was the most popular cheese in the country.
So let's look at what makes cheddar cheddar. What do we expect from a cheddar that no other cheese is going to provide us?
Well, you know, it depends a little bit on who you ask, and there's definitely different styles of cheddar, which is what makes it a little confusing to talk about, but which is also, you know, luckily what gave me enough to write about to write a whole book. But if you talk to real traditional cheddar makers, you know, it would have a bandaged, you know, or, you know, cheesecloth around it and be made, rotated, be a handmade cheese. But most cheese today, most cheddar today, is produced in large factories that make it in kind of 640-pound blocks. And then cut it up and age it in plastic. So really, there's a huge variety of things that are called cheddar, and the only definition in the United States, at least, has to do with the milk fat content and the moisture content. You know, if you hit those things, you get cheddar. But generally, what people are looking for when they buy a cheddar is kind of a sharp, bitey flavor, maybe some sweet flavor too, but just, you know, good cheese that can go with almost anything.
Right. And isn't there a huge difference if you like buy this so-called cheddar that's processed and shoved in a plastic thing at the supermarket and versus real cheddar? There's such a difference in flavor.
Well, yeah, there really is. The the real traditional cheddars, there's still a name controlled protection, you know, kind of like for champagne, for certain English cheddars. And those, definitely have distinct flavor differences. And that style went extinct in the United States for about 20 years, but it was brought back in the 90s. And there are actually more makers of that style traditional cheddar in the United States now than there are in England. Definitely for the cheddar that most people eat. And, you know, I grew up on Kraft Singles and Velveeta, like most, Americans of my age. You know, once you taste the real thing, it's really an incredible difference.
Do you know, I thought we were poor when I was a kid because my friends ate those Singles and my friends ate Velveeta, and it was not allowed. Neither one were allowed in our house. Now I know why. So let's look at Wisconsin, because we kind of think in America we think of Wisconsin and cheese. And you had an interesting story in the book, because the book is part of your travel journey. So maybe we should tell listeners what it's about. It's not just about the history. It's about the culture and how people have different references. For example, in Wisconsin, you were talking with a taxi driver. You said they just love to talk about it. But in Vermont, they do not.
No, I really thought, because I'd spent a lot more time in Wisconsin than I had in Vermont. Even though I work in cheese professionally, and Vermont has lots of cheeses, but I really thought Vermont would be like Wisconsin in terms of, you know, you go to Wisconsin, and the cab driver, you take a cab from the airport in Wisconsin, and the cab driver is going to tell you about cheddar. He's not going to say, oh, you work in cheese, oh, let me ask you a question. No, he's going to tell you what the best cheddar is and assume that you don't know. Whereas any other state in the country, really, it's even if they make a lot of cheese, there's just not that same kind of cheese pride that you get in Wisconsin. It's a very special place for cheddar.
And so you say that on your, you mentioned earlier the Champagne region France for Champagne, and cheddar has the same kind of implications about that. You say there's nothing perfectly traditional about cheese. So tell us what you mean by that.
Well, cheese, if you look at what cheese is, you know, basically it's taking milk and trying to extend its life. You know, you're taking this protein and you're trying to make it last longer so that people can eat it at a later date and that, you know, people can have enough food to eat at a later date. Cheddar is a real intervention into the process of, say, fluid milk in that it's designed to be aged a long time. And that's kind of all the technical changes that they've made to cheddar over the years have been so that it can age longer without going bad. I mean, you know, if you read the old books of the 1800s, you know, they talk about cheese blowing up and cheese being filled with maggots and right. You know, all these nasty things. And, all those things have kind of been, improved upon. I guess the cheese is always a little bit of a moving target, you know, in that, you know, people are improving the process the whole time. If you look at the English protection of cheddar, it allows for a lot of things you wouldn't think of with a traditional cheddar, for instance. I had always assumed that it was only like the cloth-bound farm-made cheeses, but they actually allow kind of the 40-pound block style with the unrinded cheddars as mm-hmm. well into that that name control. So, you know, it's one of those things that even the name controls don't really protect you.
Okay. And I read in the book that you said the most surprising fact came many years ago. Soon after the U.S. factory system started, the U.K. imported in huge volumes. I mean, the U.K. was importing cheddar. The town cheddar is in England. Your question to yourself was, what did America do to screw that up? Because things did change.
Yeah, they definitely did. You know, it's funny. I really wanted to. I had already written in the book some joke about, like, selling Coles to Newcastle,
yes,
you know, and
really.
Comparing selling cheddar to in cheddar. But then I realized that joke had been made since like the 1950s or probably even the 1800s. So I had to take it out of the book. What happened in the late 1800s is fascinating. There was this thing, they call it filled milk cheese, and basically you take all the good wholesome butter fat out of cheese and you replace it with cheap vegetable oil. And that's what a lot of Americans started doing in the 1800s, which is what ruined kind of America's reputation as a cheese exporter, and it totally destroyed the export business to England at that time for cheddar. England started buying their cheddars from Canada instead of the United States, and it really changed the trajectory of American cheese making. Because when I started in cheese in the 90s, the idea that there would be any export of American cheese was just kind of ludicrous. Like, nobody even talked about it. But then, to find that back 100 years before, America had been doing tons of that, was really a fascinating little tidbit of information.
Yeah. I thought, how can you write a whole book about cheddar? But it was really interesting. There's so much information in there. So let's look at some of the celebrities of what you call the new cheese movement, and thinking of Jasper Hill. Tell us what Jasper Hill is, and where we can find out more about them and what they're doing.
Oh, sure. Well, Jasper Hill, it's a couple of brothers and their families started this small cheese making operation in Vermont, and their mission was kind of to inspire everyone else in Vermont to go back to cheese making, to try to save the landscape, to try to bring back dairy farming in Vermont, because Vermont, like everywhere else, had lost so many dairy farms and so many cheese factories. But then they realized that, they were working really, really, really hard, and they weren't really setting a great example. They wanted to be able to take vacations some days and do things like that. So then they started, they turned their operation kind of a different direction, which is that they built these huge caves to age cheese for themselves and for other people, so that, small family farmers could take that step out of the process. They could make the cheese, then age it somewhere else. And so that became a really interesting project that they're working on in Vermont. And, their collaboration with Cabot, which is, a large dairy cooperative, one of the biggest cheddar producers in the country, they make a traditional style cheddar at Cabot, but then age it at Jasper Hill. And that's one of the things that's made it so that Jasper Hill can produce all these other amazing cheeses, too. It brings in enough revenue to make it sustainable.
Right.
And they can really experiment with these kind of new American cheeses that we've never had here before. Cheeses like Winnemere, which is a raw milk, bark-rinded cheese that's seasonal, that's out just about now. But also these amazing blues like Bailey Hazen Blue, the Harbison, which is another bark-wrapped cheese that's all year round. But really has cheddar has helped make that happen, and it's really an amazing thing.
We've only got 30 seconds left here, Gordon, but we've got the holidays coming up, and so I wanted to ask you very quickly, if we want to put together a small cheese platter with, say, 3 or 4 different cheeses that have good balance, what's your recommendation?
Of all kind of cheeses, I would say, right now, go grab a Winnemere if you can find one, or a Harbison. That's good soft cheese. For a cheddar, you're in Seattle, so, you should get some Beecher's cheddar, maybe. And then, a nice Alpine-style cheese like the Pleasant Ridge Reserve from Wisconsin would be great.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being with us. And I know listeners can find out more about you at GordonZola.net, GordonZola.net. You're coming to Seattle soon, is that right?
I'm coming to Seattle in March 21st at Elliott Bay.
Well, ping us, and we'll let our listeners know, okay?
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gordon, for being with us. And the book, again, is called Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese, and what it can tell us about our history, cultural identity, and food politics. Really interesting read. And my guest, of course, Gordon Edgar, and I know you can find him on Facebook. All right, that brings us right to the end of today's show. If you have any questions or comments, please do call me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. You can also email at info@conversationslive.net. You can find us on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and also on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.